Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Getting Hammered. I'm your host, Mary Catherine Hamm. I'm here with my co-host, Vic Mattis of the Washington Free Beacon. We are your morning show for any hour. We're coming off spring break, right? I don't know if your spring break is the same as ours. We'll discuss. We've got news, some Easter news, some trans visibility news, some updates about Israel and the possible widening of that conflict, and of course, the spoiled children of American universities. But before we get to all of that, how you doing, Vic?
Hello, Mary Catherine, and happy Easter to you. To answer your question, we have a week difference with the kids. So my son's week is now. My daughter's week was last week. But they overlapped on Thursday, and I threw in Monday there, and that's why we went to Charleston.
Nice. How was Charleston?
So lovely. We arrived, and it just stopped raining. It was just beginning to stop, tapering off, as they say. And, you know, sometimes when you, I was looking forward to so much eating, as you can imagine. And what happens is you get so excited. It's the first meal that becomes the most memorable. It's like unbelievable. You'll never have anything like it. And it was true. There were lovely meals throughout the rest of our time. But that first meal, wow.
Yeah.
And I forced the kids and my wife. We had gone all the way back. You know, you take a cab, which was an experience all itself. Let me recommend Uber. A bit much in terms of how much they charge airport fees and things like that. But we went to the hotel, and then I made them all get back in an Uber to go back up to North King Street. And we went to what I think is the greatest fried chicken place of all time, Leon's.
Okay.
It's called Leon's Fine Poultry and Oysters. And I had both oysters and fried chicken.
Oh, I love it.
I mean, it doesn't
That's
get better than
combo,
that.
A great combo,
yes. It is a great combo, and it was raw oysters. They do grilled oysters, which apparently they're famous for. And I just had, I'm like, you could do, I don't know how they do this, right? It's two-piece dark or three-piece white.
Okay.
Now, what I want, personally, I want a wing, a thigh, and maybe a chicken breast.
Okay.
But I want the wing in there. I don't want a drumstick. I'm not, you know, people love drumstick. That's not my thing.
Oh, I like a drumstick.
I like
it. It has a handle.
It does, but so does, but you know, it's got all that weird stuff on there, and you're dealing with the various things, and I don't mind the gristle and the cartilage, but it's I like to get it down to the bone. You get a wing, I can clean that off so easily, and
the
I
flats,
got that.
The flats.
Absolutely. In fact, that's what it said on there. Flats. Mm-hmm. Good for you. Well, you're from that.
I am.
Your
indeed.
Region. and I had it with this hot honey sauce and honey on fried chicken. Hot honey and fried chicken. Just kill me now.
Yeah.
Kill me now. So,
well, you're on your way.
That was, believe me. So what I ended up eating twice there and another place called Rudy Royale, which was also nice, but not as good as Leon's. I just got half chickens for myself.
I mean, fair.
You know, and I asked the waitress, is a half chicken too much for one person? And she goes, oh, I've seen it done before.
It's on the large side, but I'm not mad at that.
No. I was just like, oh, you're about to see it again. So I did that, and I exposed myself twice to grits. Twice.
Didn't know where that sentence was going.
Exposed myself, ..
Twice.
It's a new, lot of college, you know, it's a college town.
Okay, so I assume you had shrimp and grits somewhere.
I had shrimp and grits before at Husk. So instead, I had the first one, it was Good Friday. So it was like their vegetable foraging grits thing. So it's mushrooms and spinach and peppers.
I like it.
And some melted cheese of some sort on the grits. And it was quite nice. And then the second time was breakfast grits with scramble. It was like scrambled eggs and chopped up sausages and potatoes and a sausage gravy.
Yeah, like a grit hash situation.
Yes, it was a grit hash. Oh, and it was at Miller's all day. And I liked it. You know, I kept them expecting more cream of wheat.
No.
And the Waffle House grits are a little bit different.
Well, the Waffle House grits can get a little gloopy.
Yes.
Right? Because we're doing mass quantities and they're not always, supervised in the way that the grits should be.
Yeah.
Now, I still eat Waffle House grits.
Sure.
And if you get a good batch, like maybe at the beginning of the day.
Beginning
of the day at Waffle House? There is no end to the day at Waffle House.
That's a good point.
So, but if you get a nice fresh batch, and I like the just like liquid butter they squeeze on top of there.
Yes.
It needs to be in rivulets around the side. That's where you want You want those grits to be yellow. You don't want them to be white. That's not what we're looking for.
That would be a bad sign. Okay, that's good to know.
But I love a good grit. I don't make them for myself, though. They're kind of a pain, which is why they get gloopy
right?
They're left unattended.
Well, I figured I might as well take advantage of it. And I didn't want to get anything. I said, you know, we're down there, you know, and I said, we're not getting pizza. We're not. And I'm sure there are great places for pizza and Asian or anything like that. No Asian.
You're going.
No Asian.
There's a prohibition.
A prohibition. And I said, I want to go here so that I want to get to the point where I'm just so sick of it that I'll be ready to leave and say, okay, and then I'm done. But I could have eaten fried chicken every day. That would have been the death of me.
It's so good.
That's what I have for you, Mary Catherine.
All right.
How are you?
I am good. I also had a Southern food odyssey just by virtue of going home.
Oh, yes. To North Carolina.
So we went to North Carolina.
Very nice.
And I have to say, big shout out to the grandparents in our family, because when we come with our four children to North Carolina, you know, we contribute here and there. Like if you need me to move furniture or you know, make the table or set the table or make some sweet tea or something, I can pitch in here and there. Do you need a side? Maybe I can do that. But largely, Steve's parents and my parents are like, we got it covered for you. The holiday is covered. And that includes Christmas, by the way. We have to sometimes cut down on the number of gifts we're giving because the grandparents are like, they're there.
You can't match the grandparents.
Well, and it's great. It's also great because, first of all, we pretty much only do gifts on birthday and Christmas. Mm-hmm. So that's our kids are primed for that. But there is a big haul at Christmas. But the point being, we travel with the four kids and then like everything is there. We're not transporting a ton of stuff. I don't even need Easter baskets when I go to North Carolina because I know that one set is going to have them. So thank you for that. Thank you for our childhood homes and using all the square footage to put Easter baskets and things in so that I don't have to worry about it.
There's something, it's so wonderful to be able to, this is what it was like when I would go, you know, visit my parents and bring the kids up to Toms River. Just kick back, relax, everything's taken care of. And, you know, I mean, and they like to just do everything.
Yeah.
Really, my mother. Yeah, my father's around, but really, it's my mother. She'll, you know, and she likes to play with the kids. It's just like,
it's a nice
time
setup
off for you. Yeah.
It's a nice setup. So we really enjoyed that. The outfits worked.
Oh, yeah.
So I was pleased by that.
Everybody cooperated.
The outfits looked good. I didn't say the people did what they were supposed to do. Nonetheless, when you get pictures of crying kids, sometimes those are the more memorable pictures.
Those are good.
I find that the two babies were happy to do anything other than take pictures, actually. They were just happy as could be. And then you put them on your lap for a picture. They're like,
but they know something's up.
They looked fantastic.
Yeah.
The baby boy in particular. Speaking of shout outs, shout out to him. Just over a year old, wearing a fedora that his mother bought him for Easter with his Velcro boat shoes and his khakis and his sweater vest with a polo under it. You can see it on my Instagram. It's fantastic.
A fedora.
He wore a fedora. He kept it on the whole day.
Wow.
He
likes it. He likes the hat.
On his hat. And there was a wonderful moment where he was sitting with two grandpas up at a table in the backyard with his little hat on and his sweater vest. And it looked like just three old guys about to play cards. And he was just enjoying himself up there with a sippy cup. But anyway, nice to see
just
all the cousins.
Missing a cigar.
Yes. My brother came into town with his kids, so there was tons of cousin time. We were going back and forth between Durham and Raleigh. Oh, I watched the Pack go to the Elite Eight in Raleigh.
I was about to ask you if you watched much March Madness. Now, you don't have you did have.
Yes.
Sorry. My condolences.
Oh, it's okay. Well, I can talk through my feelings about this. So I watched with Steve's family, I watched the Pack advance to the Elite Eight, NC State, earlier in the night, Friday night? And then I went to Durham and with my two brothers, who I don't get to watch basketball with very often anymore, but was a huge part of my childhood, we gathered at 9:50 tip-off to watch Duke advance to the Elite Eight in a game that, frankly, they shouldn't have won. It was like, there were like 13 turnovers. It was a nasty, nasty game against Houston. But they did win.
Yes.
And then it was Duke State, which is in the Final Four, as you all know by now.
It's Civil War.
Duke lost. NC State won. I am not as committed a basketball fan as I used to be. When I was a child, I was rabid. A rabid Duke fan. Yes, I know. It's the thing everyone hates most about me. Deal with it.
It's particularly because you didn't go to Duke, but you adopted it.
Well, I was a townie.
You were a townie. Yes, of course.
And by the way,
that counts.
I feel like that earns it even harder.
Yes.
Because in Durham, there's, especially in the 80s, we had Duke basketball and Bull Durham and disproportionate amounts of street crime. So those are the three things, violent crime.
Youth.
Those are the three hallmarks of Durham when I was a child. And so Duke basketball was the one that I gravitated toward.
Thank goodness.
And we lived just blocks from campus, so we would see the players around. And at any rate, so I was a huge fan. My brothers remain better fans than I am. But I got to tell you, all the stress comes back when you're watching those March Madness games. I was just fully invested at that moment. However, look, NC State deserved to win that game.
They were good. I watched it from our dinner.
Yeah.
At Rudy Royale, and they really, especially in the second half, they dominated.
They're good. They look like a team of destiny. Duke was cold for two games straight. I cannot be mad. Now, if it was UNC, as it has been in the past, somewhat traumatically, if it were UNC, no, would I be happy for their fans, even though they're my friends? No, I would not be. But because it's NC State, I am happy for them. It's been since 1983. The Cardiac
Valvano.
Jim Valvano's
right.
team.
Yeah.
That went all the way. And by the way, if you haven't watched the 30 for 30.
Oh, goodness.
On the Cardiac Pack, I believe it's called Survive in Advance.
Yeah.
You should watch it. It's fantastic. It's been since then that they've had a Final Four appearance. So I will be rooting for them to go all the way.
Yeah.
I'm excited for my friends in North Carolina who have been long-suffering state fans.
That's right.
And also just a little fun fact about growing up on Tobacco Road. One, it was fun to watch these two teams play back to back in their town respectively.
Yeah.
Two, when I was a child, about three or four, Reagan was in office and he was often on TV as the president is. But you know who else was on TV a lot? Jim Valvano.
Yeah.
Mike Krzyzewski.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know which one was the president because they all had dark hair.
Yeah.
And they were all always on TV. And I was like three and a half, four. And I just knew that they were all three very important in the mid-80s.
Yeah, in your world, very important.
Of equal importance.
That's right.
In the mid-80s.
Jimmy
in
V.
In Tobacco Road. Jimmy V, Mike Krzyzewski, and Reagan. Now, Dean Smith, I did not get confused because he was gray-haired.
Yes.
So.
Oh, yeah, Reagan. Reagan never had white hair. I have more hair than gray hair than Reagan ever did. Kate's cousin, he went to undergrad UConn and he got his master's at Duke. So he's a great guy.
Yeah.
But when it comes to basketball, he's unbearable. And I was going to joke with him. I didn't get a chance to send him a text. I said, so after Duke lost, did you just take off the shirt and then underneath it is the UConn shirt? And he's like, I said, it must be hard to always be winning. It's just always winning.
I still have a, that's like me with Duke and Georgia. Duke basketball,
just,
Georgia football.
Oh, just back.
But I have a 1988 tournament shirt from the 1-point win, Christian Laettner buzzer beater, 79-78. I believe it was 1988, over UConn.
Yeah.
Still have that sitting in my closet. Can still wear it. Okay.
It's the same season where he stepped on a player. Sorry, didn't bring that up.
I believe that was a later season.
Actually. Oh, it was in a later season.
That was several. Sorry. That was maybe two seasons later.
All bunched together with Christian Laettner and me. Okay.
If you watch another 30 for 30,
this is
I
a
hate
very
Christian
good
Laettner.
No, I saw that. It's a very
if
good
you
one.
Watch that, I want all of you to understand and you'll just hate me more. That documentary is just a highlight reel of the most wonderful moments of my childhood. Just I'm just like,
and the worst for many other
and the
people's
worst for
childhoods.
So many other people.
Yes.
Anyway, okay, we should talk about the news or something.
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, there was some Easter-related news out of the White House, and you know what? I'm gonna do a little scaling back of the culture war here, Vic.
Okay.
I don't know which side of this you're on. There was an announcement, a proclamation, from the White House.
Yes, there was.
That March 31st was Trans Visibility Day. And given that March 31st is Easter, people got very mad about this.
Yeah.
That part's fine. Be mad. And I don't say that in the condescending internet way. Stay mad. No, I don't mean it like that. I mean, like, there's an argument for that.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of talk about how he had
hijacked,
proclaimed it Trans Visibility Day because it was Easter.
Oh, right.
And I immediately, because I like to test my preconceived notions, I looked up Trans Visibility Day after I caught on that this was a thing,
right.
And was like,
because it went wild, it was like wildfire.
It did, and I wasn't really online, so I caught it late. But I said, well, March 31st has been Trans Visibility Day since the time that it was founded, which was like 2014
right.
or so. we can have an argument about whether there should be a Transvisibility Day. We can have an argument about whether the White House should recognize Transvisibility Day, particularly when it coincides with Easter. Right. But I do not think that they created Transvisibility Day as an insult to Easter. What are your thoughts?
Yes, that would be inaccurate to say that. And a lot of the people who are outraged, and I get it, by the way, mm-hmm. and we'll get to that outrage in a second. We're saying, I can't believe that it is now from this moment on, Easter is now Transvisibility Day. Easter is like Thanksgiving. It's a different day every year.
Yes,
but even more
up.
So because the Lenten season, I mean, it's more stretched out.
Yes.
I mean, and this was a very
super early Easter.
Yeah. Easter. Normally it's in April, you know, or whatever. So it happens from time to time that it happens to be in March. And so that got into the mix of confusion. The statement that the president releases, though, you know, he talks about he says that he declares, you know, that, you know, March 31st, right? Mm-hmm. Again, as you mentioned, which has always been, but he says in the year of our Lord, you know, so it's like this extra dig.
Well,
and
everyone's
like, oh no.
Well, you know? And not just that, the Twitter, this is where I come down on the side of those who are mad. The Twitter post says you're made in the image of God and you're worthy of respect and dignity on the Transgender Day post, which like if you go to the end of that verse, it's male and female, he created them. So
it
does seem to be a little bit of a
And the thing is, it wasn't just so everyone's like, look, everyone on the left, I should say. But people are saying, you know, Biden didn't do this himself. He doesn't, you know, you have some flunky who does these things. I get it. But
sure.
He ought to know what's going out. Right.
OK. So here's let me just add a little metric here because I was curious.
Yes.
The proclamation.
Yeah.
On Transvisibility Day. Is 638 words long. The Easter print release statement is 94 words long.
Yeah.
Okay. So look, I think that the White House, this administration's White House, let's put Biden's personal feelings aside.
Yeah.
Do I think this administration's White House and its staff care more about Transgender Visibility Day than Easter and found it sort of thrilling that it landed on the same day this year? Yes, I do.
Totally.
Yes, totally. I do. By the way, did you see this weird? It wasn't the president's tweet, but it was at Joe Biden, which is his separate like campaigning.
Okay.
So I guess that's the campaign.
All right.
This is his Easter post. To all those gathering in churches and homes around the world today, happy Easter. May God bless you and keep you. Nothing about Jesus. Nothing about Christians. It's like a weird. Do you happen to be in a church today?
The construction of it.
Yes.
The construction of it.
Whereas on the White House one, it is more as we gather with loved ones, we remember Jesus' sacrifice. Is that perhaps because the campaign needs to be as lefty as possible to energize the base?
Well, that's the thing. You would think that they'd be, you know, again, really going after, you know, independents, the Never Trumpers, the people who wanted Nikki Haley or DeSantis or whoever else. And instead, there seems to be a real heavy emphasis on catering to the needs and desires of the far left. And that tells me that they're very concerned about shoring up that base right now. And that's like they're worried about trying to if they spend any more time trying to capture the center, they're going to lose that left or they're just not going to show up, which is what you're seeing in polls.
Also, I would just say that all campaigns are really vulnerable to being too online. This is a fail.
Sure.
Of so many campaigns, and Joe Biden's should be careful about that because Transgender Visibility Day, which, by the way, is in addition to Transgender Day of Remembrance, which is in a different month, than Transvisibility Month, which I think is a different month.
And Transvisibility Year, which is the
Whole
year.
Can I also just say, visibility is not the problem, guys. That's
no.
Easter
is one day, and this is, I think, how Christians feel like, can you just give us this one day?
But no, sorry, and the answer is no.
No, and so you had these tweets, you know, from Kamala Harris, Javier Becerra, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. His little video thing or tweet was, you know, thing like, as we, you know, we think about, you know, our, as he says, our non-binary two-spirit, you know, friends.
Right.
How many of the two spirits are out there? And so
block.
It's a huge voting block for the two spirits. And I will say, you love to hear it.
Yeah.
You gotta love to hear it.
Nice.
Cardinal Wilton Gregory, or Wilton Cardinal Gregory, if you will, who is the cardinal here of Washington, D.C., and I think that means he's also the archbishop as well. Not a friend of the right. A lot of the serious traditional Catholics do not like him.
Right.
He's more lefty, loosey-goosey, more Jesuit than Dominican, shall we say. Not that he's either. I'm just saying. He said, and he was on one of the Sunday talk shows, that Joe Biden, he called Joe Biden a cafeteria Catholic.
Oh, I saw that. We should play some audio of that.
There is a phrase that we have used in the past, a cafeteria Catholic. You choose that which is attractive and dismiss that which is challenging.
And he's right. And so, you know, I don't often see eye to eye with, you know, Cardinal Gregory, but he's right. And this is something that I believe the late Cardinal O'Connor in New York used to say this as well, which is, you know, you can't pick and it's not the buffet where you just pick and choose right. what you like. We all do that, and I get it. And Joe Biden is very similarly, you know, people say, well, you know, you can't say that he hates Catholics or the church. He goes to church every Sunday. A lot of people go to church every Sunday. You know, we're not all angels, myself included. And the thing is, all we're doing and all Joe Biden is doing, like lots of folks do, is it's a very natural human, common human impulse to seek validation. And I've spoken about this before. And just like, please tell me what I'm doing is good. And yes, Biden managed to find a church down the street, you know, just across the river, where they will give him communion,
right?
You know, despite his positions and opinions on abortion or whatever. That's not what it's about. It's supposed to be hard for everybody, myself included. It's not easy.
Yeah, as I've been listening, by the way, to Father Mike in the Bible in a Year podcast.
Yes, I'm very familiar with him, Mary Catherine, as you know.
He's often reminding us that challenging readings are part of the deal.
Right.
That when you go through the begats and the... and the various maps. Yeah. And yes, the very outdated notions about women and treatment of other people and that kind of thing in the Old Testament, that you're supposed to be challenged with this. And then, you know, that you sort of think through right. it and pray through it. By the way, I would just, when people say it's just some staffer doing a rote
right.
release just about a once every day event, fine. Obviously, the president is not writing these releases, and nor should he be. But you're sort of admitting that if indeed Joe Biden is this weekly attending, very devout Catholic,
right,
the thing that his White House is reflecting to the public is not that. They're reflecting that his priority is something else. Because the other tweet from POTUS, and this is the White House account, on Easter Sunday, was in honor of Cesar Chavez.
Oh.
And it was longer than the Easter Post, too. It's like a lot of things, like several things seem to come before this other very important thing.
Other thing.
So,
which a lot of people celebrate.
People are not crazy to see that when they see 638 words for Transgender Awareness Day or Visibility Day and 94 for Easter.
By the way, speaking of Cesar Chavez, a friend of ours worked for him many, many years ago. And when he was of that persuasion of the left, but he said that having gotten to work along with Cesar Chavez, that he was actually fiercely anti-illegal immigrant.
Yes. So I have heard. Is that part airbrushed a bit?
Yeah, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So that being we've de-escalated a bit in the culture war.
Yeah.
But do I think those staffers loved that it fell on Easter? Yes.
Oh,
yes, I do. If I could imagine that, yes. And do I think this is a shift culturally, like in the Obama administration, I would have to look up exactly what they did on Trans Visibility Day, but I do think that in the Obama administration, they would have been smart enough and times were different enough that they would have held off on a trans visibility announcement should it have landed on Easter.
Right.
I bet Obama, knowing he had to...
2009 was a different world, as you
totally
know.
Totally different.
A year earlier, both he and Hillary Clinton said they are not in favor of gay marriage.
I know.
Let alone... anything where we are now.
That is wild. But by the way, I was on a Bill Maher's show one time and said, this is years ago before Bill Maher was and I were a little bit more in agreement, but I said on air that Dick Cheney was for gay marriage before Barack Obama was. And the audience booed me. I believe this is correct. And Bill, I'm trying to make sure that I remember this accurately. And Bill Maher said, no, she's right. She's right. That is a real thing.
Yeah.
But it messes with people's minds. Okay. Shall we
move
on to...
It was a hostile crowd back then, wasn't it?
It was.
I used to watch it in sort of terror.
It's more friendly now.
Yeah.
It's more friendly now. To me. Which is nice. or at least not scary.
Yeah, yeah. Those people, they all went. They all go to the Colbert Show now.
Oh, yes. All right. Well, let's move on to some news from the Middle East.
Oh, yes.
All right. So this is the Wall Street Journal reporting. Syria and Iran accused Israel of a missile attack on an Iranian diplomatic building in Damascus that killed a senior Iranian general in a potential escalation of a shadow war between Israel and Iran that has intensified during the war on Gaza. Well, it ain't that shadow because everyone knows that Iran is funding everyone on every side of it.
The proxy war.
Right, on every side of Israel, particularly Hezbollah in Lebanon to the north and Hamas in Gaza to the south. Iranian state media said the attack on Monday killed a senior leader in the elite Quds force of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, you'll see them referred to as, which oversees Tehran's network of militia allies throughout the region. This is important. The commander, General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, managed Iranian paramilitary operations in Syria and Lebanon, according to the Iranian state media and U.S. officials. Seven other people were killed, members of the Revolutionary Guard as well. Here's the Israeli military's chief spokesman, Daniel Hagari. We are focused on the war goals, and we will continue to do anything that contributes to achieving those goals. A pointed non-denial on this. But it's important that it's the guy in charge of Lebanon.
Yes, exactly.
That's what they're trying to head off here.
So, yes, exactly. So, you know, we can sometimes forget that Israel's dealing with threats on multiple fronts.
Yes.
It's not just Gaza, and they're right there. They're on the cusp of, you know, ending Hamas's rule by going into Rafah, right, if they do that. But there's a whole other northern border they have to worry about. And they go after this guy who was, you know, the Hezbollah. He's a Hezbollah, Quds Force, Iranian IRGC bigwig, right, Zahedi. And it's basically, you know, again, the Israeli sort of, the point is FAFO, right?
Right.
I mean, because they're thinking the Iranians, as in their shadow proxy war, as you were just saying, are like, you know, what happens if we, since October 7, fire more than 3,500 rockets into Israel? I wonder if they're going to do anything.
Would they do anything to us?
What do you think they're going to do? And they did it. And their aim, much like during the Trump administration of taking out Qasem Soleimani, is to send that message. And it's a message to the region that they're not messing around. And of course, as we all know, and we've said this multiple times, that the region recognizes strength.
Yep.
It is much different than after the U.S. military personnel were recently killed.
Right.
And the Biden administration, you know, just like blared out, you know, to the public, we're going to retaliate. You know, hint, hint, if you're an Iranian advisor, you better get out because we wouldn't want to hit you in the retaliation. You know, that would be awkward. And so they were not making any large public announcement, the Israelis, that they're going to go after Zahedi or any of these military / you know, even possibly diplomatic, you know, personnel in Syria. I mean, that's the thing, because they tend to do multiple roles. You know,
Syria, where, by the way, the despotic leaders there have been killing fellow Arab citizens en masse for years and years, and almost no one cares about it. They only care about Palestinians in Gaza when the fight is between Jews and the Palestinian population. But that's an aside.
Similarly, by the way, in the Rafah situation, and so they have no way out. Well, there is a way. It's Egypt.
Yes.
But they're not letting anybody in. They don't want to take over, right? They don't. No one has any desire. Even the quote unquote new Palestinian Authority is, I don't know how different it is from the old Palestinian Authority, but nobody's looking forward to them. The Israelis don't want to administer those areas.
No. Like this idea that Israel's just doing a 2-week battle in a hospital because it wants to wantonly hurt people. No. First of all, if there weren't militants in the hospital, it wouldn't take 2 weeks. If Israel weren't being careful about who it hits, it wouldn't take 2 weeks.
Right.
This is the current operation that everybody is complaining about. When it comes to Lebanon, and I have only been to Israel twice, but when I go, I've always been pro-Israel. I understand they need to fight. That's just the way it is, right? And fighting actually in contrast to what people like Biden and others, maybe more in his administration than Biden himself, think, fighting actually gives you a stronger hand because, like you said, strength is recognized. But I always, even more clearly understand how much they need to fight for their own existence. And it's exhausting and it's necessary.
Right
now, there are 70 to 80,000 Israelis displaced from the north. Everyone's thinking about Gaza, but they were evacuated from the north because Hezbollah is much stronger and has many more rockets.
Hundreds of thousands of rockets.
Much more guided, much more sophisticated than Hamas does. So they thought, oh, it's imminent. People are going to come from the north as soon as possible. And they ended up flooding that area with IDF right up towards the border so that that would not be the case. The civilians are out of there. They're displaced with all these cascading effects. Mm-hmm. They're in Israel. They're in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem hotel rooms, sometimes with 5 and 6 kids, relatives' houses.
Right.
So Israel has a choice. They can now imagine the world's reaction to this, and it may eventually happen. They've been getting incoming fire from Hezbollah in Lebanon every day since October 7th. Every single one is an act of war, indiscriminate, pointed at civilians. They could go into Lebanon and make their buffer zone north of the border, which is where it should be, according to a UN resolution from a long time ago that nobody cares about because the UN doesn't care about Israel. But Hezbollah shouldn't be there, according to international law, which people very much care about. They could go in there and do that. The world will freak out, even though they've been being hit every day.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's this option of a surgical hit on the guy in charge of the paramilitary guys who are north of the border right there in Lebanon.
No, exactly. You mentioned Al-Shifa Hospital, and I believe the IDF, they said that they've captured or killed at least 700 terrorists who are hiding there. And the other thing is I saw an article about a concern about U.S. sharing too much intelligence with the Israelis.
Yeah,
you wouldn't want to do that. So, yeah.
No, I don't. There was a story out this week that the White House is going to have some meeting with top Israeli military officials about other options other than going into Rafah. And it's like, is the other option just losing?
Yeah.
Like, what's the other option?
No, again, there is no option of leaving Hamas in place.
No.
That's a real problem. And of course, the situation with the hostages, because if you just any time you're going to stall, it gives them more time to regroup, rearm. That's what we're
talking
about.
Put more civilians in front of them.
You know, this thing could end today if Hamas just says, we surrender and here are your hostages that we took on October 7th.
Yeah, and strangely, no one ever calls for that, even though one's a one-year-old and one's a four-year-old.
Yeah.
So. Babies.
You mentioned Fetterman as well.
Oh, yes. I did want to mention
Related to this.
Fetterman's...
Senator John Fetterman.
He's apparently lost several top communications staffers who've resigned to pursue more liberal positions as the Democrat combats anger from progressives over his pro-Israel stance. This is Daily Mail. Top staffers for Democrat John Fetterman are leaving his office for more progressive jobs. The everyman Democrat who loves Carhartt hoodies and donning a disheveled goatee has staunchly supported Israel's war on Hamas and denounced calls for a ceasefire. Okay, so Joe Calvello, Fetterman's longtime communications director who helped him navigate a tumultuous Senate race working on the campaign, that navigate means lied to everybody about his health state, left to work with liberal Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson earlier this month. Oh, what a move. Mayor Johnson is a true progressive who is ruining his city. I'm sorry, no, that's not what it says. Who is committed to fighting for the working people and families of the city of Chicago. Nick Gavio, Fetterman's deputy communications director, started with his campaign. We'll leave the office at the end of the month to work for the Working Families Party.
Yes, also known as the Socialist Working Families
and
Party.
And Emma Mustyun, who served in Fetterman's office as a press and digital aide, also left the office to work for Senator Bob Casey's reelection bid. That's not as much of a move for progressivism because Casey's like kind of, he's just a quiet version.
Yes. Well, this is good for Dave McCormick's campaign to point out that they have this insane lefty over there over in the Casey campaign.
True.
I love how they all landed somewhere. Like there's not somebody who resigned and said, and is looking for new opportunities. You know, they're all somewhere and it's all to the left. You mentioned Brandon Johnson, the mayor of Chicago, you know, doing a bang up
job. I mean, that's a move, man.
Yeah. But I'll say this when I heard
that when they're morally backwards, they're really morally backwards.
All in. I thought, well, okay, I guess that means that there are openings for John Fetterman now. And maybe
And he don't need a communications director. He's been doing just fine.
Yeah, yeah.
He's been doing just fine on his own.
Loud and clear.
You know who could use a communications director? The idiotic students at Vanderbilt University who did a sit-in. So they did they occupied one of the administration buildings at Vanderbilt because of a fight with the administration over whether they could have a vote on divestments from Israel. Anyway. It's a very
That's a big thing now, is thing to tell do, your right. university to stop investing in
yes, yes. So they, that help they have Israel. To divest from Israel and have nothing to do with it whatsoever. Just the only liberal democracy with, you know, gay people living freely in the yeah. Middle East. But, you know, whatever. Not important to college students. So they do like a 21-hour sit-in at the administration building. And these children, who are actually adults, but let's call them children because they're acting like children, had this to say after they were arrested, which on Vanderbilt.
Yes, yes.
For doing so. You Kudos. Need to disincentivize this behavior. They can have a protest, but they don't get to, like, take over buildings and ruin everyone else's experience
on campus.
No, like
this is like the late 60s at Columbia University
yes.
or whatever.
By the way, I saw that University of Michigan also punished 70s. Students who, pro-Hamas, pro-Palestine mm-hmm. students, who interrupted the honors convocation at University of Michigan. And they punished them by telling them they will not be allowed in that building for their own graduation ceremonies. So, F-A-F-O.
Yeah,
okay?
Once again.
But you have to punish people for this because it's not free speech to interrupt everyone else's stuff.
Right.
Okay, but let me just play you a little bit. There was a lot of drama at the actual sit-in.
Oh, yeah.
But let's hear the debrief from one of these students about what it was like
right.
to be there.
Water delivered to us. They deprived us of the right to use in the restroom. They deprived us of medical care when some of our students needed it. And in essence, they tried to break us. They tried to break our bodies. They tried to break our spirits. They broke my voice a little bit, clearly. But they're not going to manage because they all think like individuals, and we're thinking as a collective, and we're thinking of everybody here when we do this, and we're thinking of everybody in Gaza when we do this, because we care about each other and we care about protecting each other.
All right, the whole deal. Kafia.
Yeah, why the mask?
Are
they worried about getting COVID?
It's just part of, like, it's a starter pack for being a liberal on campus. You have a kafia.
And the mask.
Have a mask.
Yeah.
But.
Your K90.
Okay, 21 hours. You broke into, you forced yourself into an administration building. And then your demand is that they feed and clothe and give you medical care while you're there. Inside the building that you're not supposed to be in.
Right.
It's wild.
There is another video clip, by the way, of some of these protesters heckling a security guard.
Yes.
You saw that because he happens to be black.
Yes.
And trying to shame him for, you know, working for the man.
Yeah, I'll play it. I can play a little bit of that one.
And the police officers are standing by like puppets.
Shame on you.
Puppets.
Even Jack.
Okay.
Yeah. Who wants to leave? Not you're protecting a terrible man. Too. I hope you know that. You're protecting a terrible man.
And a coward, too.
And a coward, an absolute coward, who is aiding and abetting a actual genocide. 30,000 people are being killed, sir.
That's what you're protecting.
Show your compassion. Show your morality.
What if it was your kids?
Mm. Would you
it
care?
It will be your kids. It will be our kids. You and your kids gonna protect you? This is
a job worth it, sir? Is a job worth it?
And you're black, sir. We're already dealing with this. You can stand with us.
32,000 dead, and you don't care.
You could stand with us right now and be on the right side of history.
But you won't.
Shame on you. Shame on you.
Shame. You are black in America, and you're not standing with the marginalized people of the world. What does that make you? What does that make you? A coward.
Coward.
Shame.
Okay, I just want to say, it's hard to tell because they're masked, but I think the person saying that, you're protecting a terrible man, it might be the cameraman, but there's a person the camera is on who is wearing a Vanderbilt long-sleeved t-shirt, a pair of khakis with Argyle socks, and I just want to say we have a winner for whitest white privilege, and it is that guy. It is that guy. Yelling at a black cop, possibly. I don't want to smear him.
Yeah.
He's got this mask on, so I can't tell. But I think he was the one talking. It's ridiculous. These people are ridiculous. There was another female student reported on by... This is Steve McGuire, by the way, who's reporting all of this mm-hmm. from Vanderbilt, and then Susie Weiss wrote at the Free Press about one woman who called 911 from this sit-in to tell them that her emergency was that if she got up and left this facility, she would be arrested. However, she had a tampon in, and she might get toxic shock syndrome mm-hmm. if it were not changed promptly.
It's time to pull the plug on this protest.
I haven't heard so much fuss about a tampon since like early middle school. I mean, this is like, and again, these are supposed to be adults.
Yes.
Think it through before mm-hmm. you go to the sit-in. Mm-hmm. No one is obligated to give you medical care and yeah. food. And yeah. it's like me breaking into someone's house and being like, they did not even make me pizza rolls.
Right. It's again, the privilege
injustice.
Thing is really quite, it's quite remarkable what they expect. You know, the sense of entitlement, including when it comes to protests, this is not storming. This is not the ramparts and like at the end of Les Miserables,
right.
you know, where they're just.
Whatever happened to protests is supposed to make people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Y'all don't have to be uncomfortable?
Yeah. No.
Apparently not.
No, I that would be like me doing a hunger strike, which is just a couple of snacks in between, maybe skipping breakfast, but it's not lunch. I mean, that would be crazy.
They did. Remember the Texas progressive congressman who
yes.
did a hunger strike for like 9 hours? And I was like, that's just an
he had
that's
the
a
aide,
small intermittent
he had
fast.
The, yes, he had the aide with him with the bottled water and the look on his face.
I believe he had a compress
yeah.
on
yeah.
his head.
Yes.
Woof.
Like oh, and he had the finger pulse thing
yeah.
to check your
same
you
vibe.
Check, you gotta
same
check
vibe.
Check the pulse.
Same vibe.
Yeah.
By the way, Jamie Raskin was speaking at the University of
yes.
it was University of Maryland, and he was shouted down. He
Jamie
was
Raskin, because he's such a rabid right-winger.
Right. Well, and he was somewhat ironically talking about democracy, autocracy, and the threat to reason in the 21st century. I would argue that his hecklers are part of the threat to reason, but probably not who he was referencing in this speech. But the most crazy part about this is this is the quote from the president of the university.
Yeah.
Daryl Pines stepped in. He terminated the lecture early.
Yeah.
So he cuts off the actual speaker. Says he came here to speak about where our democracy is going in our country. What you saw play out actually was democracy and free speech and academic freedom. From our perspective as a university, there are difficult conversations that we should be having. That's not a conversation. I'm no Raskin fan, but if I were there, mm-hmm. I would be arguing for his ability to have his say so I could then ask him a tough question or two.
Right. What's being implied here is that you saw it play out and freedom of speech won by the people who forced themselves.
Yeah.
You know, violently or otherwise, verbally, physically, whatever, and bully their way, you know, to dominate this conversation, and the other side loses. When the president says that you're watching this play out, yes, you're watching it play out and die.
Yeah.
That's what you're watching it. You know, democracy died in this talk. It was terrible.
So then the congressman, for his part, says, I'm not really opposed to heckling. But it seems like heckling today is all about drowning out the speaker, and that's totally antithetical to the spirit of free expression. I agree with him, although I think he's confused about the definition of heckling.
Yeah.
Because heckling is an aggressive attempt to disrupt the speaker, which is what is happening here. So I'm not sure how you're opposed to heckling.
In his mind, the occasional boo.
I guess, yeah.
You suck.
He's pro-heckling, but not
let's shut it
disruptive
down.
Heckling. Okay.
Right. And
I think both of these men are misunderstanding the basics of this.
These people will never be placated.
Right.
Because they're also going after AOC.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, she's not against Israel enough.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know what the other option is.
No, this is just
people.
Their...
You think about, yeah.
This is just their raison d'etre, right? This is
yeah.
like,
That's
as
right.
humans, this is what mm-hmm. they are called to do. And I don't mean that in like, we're just doing the right thing as humans. I mean, this is all they do.
Right.
They can't see past it. They don't have a plan.
No.
For fixing anything.
Right.
It's just the disruption and the protest culture.
And in some cases, when you see it on TV, I mean, again, you have to remind yourself that there's a good, hopefully, majority of Americans who feel that Israel has a right to defend itself and do what it needs to do in order to never have this happen again, right? But then you have things like there was a big thing that happened at Saturday Night Live, right? Rami Youssef was the comedian.
Oh, I did hear about that, yeah.
And he went on and he talked about the need for free Palestine. He also talked about the returning of the hostages at the very least. But then...
Well, that's a nice nod to that. I'll take it. The bar is on the ground.
But, you know, then people, you know, took that and ran and showed a clip of it, like Trita Parsi did, and saying, notice this sustained thunderous applause for 10 seconds for Free Palestine. Again, did not include the part about the hostages, but right. Even the part about the Free Palestine, my question is, well, which part are we talking about here? Are we talking about Gaza and the West Bank being free as Palestine? Or are we talking about Israel?
Well, and I would say Israel, and I'm not being trolly, I'm being literal. Israel is doing the first part, which is freeing Palestinians from Hamas.
From Hamas, right. They're going to free, yes, so free from Hamas.
Whatever steps happen after
right.
that
right.
is going to some degree be in the hands of those yeah. who are not Hamas. Yeah. I understand that many of those people did not elect Hamas because they were children
right.
when Hamas was voted into power. But there is a part where, like, having the terrorists in charge of this area does not allow for ever being free. And I would argue the international community never wants them to actually be right. free, because they enable exactly right. the behavior that prevents two states living side by side, because that's not actually what they want.
Right.
Either the international community
it's
or
in
these
the
folks.
Charter, which they keep on, I don't know, ignoring or forgetting.
Yeah. All right. So academic culture, doing great.
Not great.
You're doing yeah. great. Doing great, guys. I will just... Big props to Vanderbilt and Michigan for actually punishing students
right.
for going beyond
and
free
again,
speech, because you got to do that.
And again, going back to John Fetterman, continued props to him.
Ah, yes.
It's funny, you know, we get so used to seeing candidates, or we complain about candidates who campaign from the center and then they move to the left.
Right.
He See, this like, one pulled the opposite.
The real
What's
switcheroo. It's a different
yeah.
kind of
I mean,
switcheroo.
Relatively speaking, he's not the second coming of Ted Cruz. I get it. But, you know, it's quite striking.
And I would say the thing about October 7th is, as I don't know whose quote this is, but someone said, it's the easiest moral test of my time. And to watch so many people fail it has yeah. been discouraging. Yeah. And I would imagine that's probably Fetterman's in the same boat as I am.
Yeah.
Right. Where he's like, this is obviously the correct place right. to be on this. And his communications directors are like, no, it's not. OK.
Yeah.
The New York Times is now it can be tolling again.
Oh, yeah.
Happy New York Times saying things that you said 4 years ago and acting like it's news day to all who celebrate. And
does
Vic and I celebrate.
Yeah, this is
frequently.
Does this qualify as the now it can be told?
Yeah, I think so. This is, let's call it our we were right visibility day.
Yes.
That's what this is. Why school absences have exploded almost everywhere. Subhead, the pandemic changed families' lives and the culture of education. Our relationship with school became optional. The pandemic did not change that relationship. Pandemic policies changed that relationship. Messaging from the New York Times changed that relationship.
Right.
Fudging of science from the New York Times' health reporter changed that.
Yeah.
It was not
the
merely,
one who replaced the old one.
Yeah, it was not merely the pandemic. And by the way, when the odd person, including David Leonhardt, who was often late but more correct and less late than others,
well, better late than never,
pointed out that much of this messaging was wrong and was messing with children and hurting them, he would get pilloried
yeah.
for saying it even months and months after the fact, years after the yeah. fact. But here we are. So I'm just going to read some of this story,
please.
This thoroughly depressing story, which will reveal to you the things that Vic and I and most of our listeners, because we are rational normies, knew 4 years ago. In Anchorage, affluent families set off on ski trips and other lengthy vacations with the assumption that their children can keep up with work online. In a working-class pocket of Michigan, school administrators have tried almost everything, including pajama day, to boost student attendance. And across the country, students with heightened anxiety are opting to stay home rather than face the classroom. In the 4 years since the pandemic closed schools, U.S. education has struggled to recover on a number of fronts, from learning loss to enrollment to student behavior. Wouldn't you know it? But perhaps no issue has been as stubborn and pervasive as a sharp increase in student absenteeism, a problem that cuts across demographics and has continued long after schools reopened. Nationally, an estimated 26% of public school students were considered chronically absent last year, up from 15% before the pandemic. This is recent data from 40 states in Washington, D.C., compiled by the American Enterprise Institute. Chronic absence is typically defined as missing at least 10% of the school year, or about 18 days for any reason. You know who chimed in on this? Randy Weingarten.
Oh, boy.
As New York Times shows here, our schools are seeing a rise in chronic absenteeism rates. This is the result of many factors. Many factors.
Yes.
And it's why AFT Union has been working to bring hashtag real solutions to our communities. This was the foundation of our Passion Meets Purpose conference. Shut up.
Passion Meets Purpose.
S-T. F you, Randy Weingarten, because you were the person who perhaps more loudly than anyone else told the American people that school was non-essential.
Yeah.
Being in a school was non-essential. That was your position.
Yeah.
And here we have the fruits of that position.
Well, I think she would say that she was not a doctor. She's not a scientist. But she turned to our health experts for guidance. And then you have Dr. Fauci who says, I'm not a policymaker. I don't make these decisions. I'm just doing the science part of it. But I don't actually tell people shut down the schools. They're just taking my advice. Right. Nobody actually is to blame then, as you can see.
That's so neat. They note, to be fair, that places that reopened quickly during the pandemic also have seen increases in absenteeism. I would argue partly that is because the national messaging was you don't have to be in a school building.
Right.
That was the message.
You see that in schools and you see that at work.
Yeah.
A lot of people, I'm going to work from home today.
Right.
Which is, okay, fine. If you're a senior staffer, fine. That's cool. Looking at myself.
He's going to be working from Charleston from here on out.
That would be great. But, you know, for everybody else, especially a lot of the young kids who come in, they think it's normal to work remotely and it's not. But they don't know that because they went through part of their college was remote, you know. So I get that you have to sort of explain that this is it's a different world and that we're, you know, in the olden days, people came to work 5 days a week.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the first thing.
On one hand, flexibility can be great for workers.
Right.
And sometimes can be great for families.
Right.
If they're equipped to keep their kids up to date, blah, blah, blah. Mm. But this thing where we pretend like all of this wasn't obvious when school closures started is insane. Right. So this is Katie Rosenbaum, a psychologist and associate research professor with the Center for Child and Family Policy at Duke University, says, our relationship with school became optional. And the New York Times follows on, the habit of daily attendance and many families' trust was severed when schools shuttered in spring 2020. Even after schools reopened, things hardly snapped back to normal. Districts offered remote options, required COVID-19 quarantines, and relaxed policies around attendance and grading.
Yeah.
All the things they told us wouldn't matter, Vic.
That's right. They worked really hard at pushing that message, by the way.
Yes.
And that, and you know, the teachers and these, the, you know, how courageous they were from teaching from home, I guess, you know, doing the Zooms. And again, we say this all the time, but, you know, the kids, they didn't even have to have their videos on. And God bless the teachers that really try to insist on turning your video on so they can see all the faces. But a lot of other teachers, they didn't care. And I know this just from, you know, secondhand talking to kids that, oh, yeah, you know, people were doing other things or they're playing video games or whatever. They're not going to get, because it's pandemic, nobody's going
to
be failed.
Well, but how dare you, like, bring it up to the school board that maybe they should be in school.
Absolutely.
Across the country, students are staying home when sick, not only with COVID-19, but also with more routine colds and viruses. Who could have imagined that this would happen? And more students are struggling with their mental health. One reason for increased absenteeism in Mason, Ohio, an affluent suburb of Cincinnati, said Tracy Carson, a district spokeswoman. Because many parents can work remotely, their children can also stay home. So they're working together.
Right.
And the absenteeism is making catching up, obviously, much harder. But all of this is a problem of their own making.
Right.
And when anyone suggested fixing the problem in 2020 and 2021, they were lambasted.
Shouted down or censored.
So we got a lot to do here.
There was already a problem with the, you know, this younger generation. Let's call it Gen Z Alpha.
Right.
As my daughter explains, there's a difference now. But that Jonathan Haidt book that is now out.
Yeah.
I believe it's Our Anxious Age. Is that what
our
it's called?
Our Anxious Generation.
Our Anxious Generation. They talk about the, you know, it began with the smartphone. You know, and certainly adults, we're all addicted to it. And our work follows us everywhere we go now, you know, and I talk about the benefits of, you know, having a smartphone, because when you're standing in line in the old days, you just stood there.
Now
you can read unless you brought the paper with you. Yeah. But not everybody brings a paper stand. You don't know where you're going to be standing in line. So you're always checking but the flip side is, of course, that you're never not working.
Right.
But for kids, the experience was much different. And the creation of these apps made things worse. And we're talking about, you know, TikTok and Snap and you name it. So you're seeing this uptick in
Snapchat. Don't go all boomer on us.
Oh, Snap. Oh, it's all Snapchat. What's Snap? Isn't that the same?
Is there a Snap?
My daughter explained.
Our much younger producer is looking at us and saying, no, there's not a snap.
My daughter explained what the streak is, though. There's a streak, which is when you go snapping. Jennifer's nodding.
Okay,
go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and see how long you get. Oh, my gosh, we had the streak going for like 2-3 months. We're just going back and forth on Snapchat. Are you doing anything else, or is it just this? You know, I mean, enough with the phone. Look around, you know.
And I told this to my boomer segment of our podcast.
I told my daughter, I said, look around. I said, you know. She didn't go with me and my son to Fort Sumter. Fine. But, you know, but and on the other hand, and I told my son, I said, don't take everything so seriously. It's not the end of the world. Appreciate these clothes on King Street, you know,
right.
But no, didn't listen to me either. No, but it is, you know, I mean, these increases in depression, in shaming, self-harm, suicide. And then on top of that, pandemic policies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a serious problem, and I don't know how we get ourselves out of it.
Teacher absences have also increased. That's sort of an aside in here, but I'd like to know more about exactly how much, because that's interesting.
I appreciate new studies coming out, though.
Yes, people are studying it. We're getting to the bottom of this.
Good.
I'm going to note right before we close off, because I got to run.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Did you see there's a new push from Republicans to name Dulles after Donald Trump?
Oh,
To which I say the libs should probably let this one go.
Yeah.
It's the Bidenomics of airports.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it's like Reagan Airport. Reagan hated D.C. The idea that he has a statue in front of, you know, Terminal 1, like being happy. He was never happy to be here. I must give a call out to Matt Klein, who I was walking last night into my supermarket, and he just went right up to me and said, are you Vic Mattis?
Wow.
And I stopped and thought, should I say yes or no? I don't know. Look at this famous guy. I took a chance and I said yes. And he said he was a big fan since your days at the Federalist.
Oh, Mary Catherine, I'm sorry about that.
So through that, loves the show, loves the drinking episodes.
Thanks for listening.
It's a lot of work, but thank you for listening. That wraps up this episode of Getting Hammered. Remember, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, YouTube. You can follow me on Twitter at Victorino Mattis.
I'm at MK Hammer on Twitter, at MK Hammer Time on Instagram, at Getting Hammered Podcast on Instagram or YouTube. You can follow us there. Thanks for getting hammered responsibly. This has been a Nebulous Media Podcast. Boom.